Representative Wogomoth has made the motion to approve the minutes. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Representative Wogomoth, I believe you are before the committee. Representative Wogomoth, you have another motion for us.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move that House File 1161 be sent to the General Register.
And Representative Wogomoth, do you have an amendment that you need to offer to put the bill into order?
Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment. It is coded A2, and with your permission, I would like to move the A2 amendment.
Representative Wogomoth moves the A2 amendment to the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A2 amendment is pretty simple. It makes a technical change that has been brought forward to me by the request of the MnState system. The goal here is just to make sure that we do what we want the bill to do and not have any unintended consequences.
Discussion to the amendment. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Wogomoth, the bill is now in the order that you wish. So to the bill.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to come before you today to present House File 1161. The reason why I'm bringing this bill forward to you, Mr. Chair and members, is because under our current statute, faculty teaching classes outside of the traditional fall or spring semester do not qualify for union representation. House File 1161 fixes that. This will be an impactful fix for many reasons. Adjunct faculty will be the largest group impacted, as contingent employees, they often have the least protection or benefits. This provides affected faculty the ability to enjoy the same benefits and protections as faculty teaching in fall and spring semesters. They will qualify for all the benefits and protections of faculty teaching this summer and the fall. These protections include guaranteed minimum pay, tuition waivers, paid leave, access to professional development, resources, and more. The ultimate goal of this bill, Mr. Chair and members, is to maintain the minimum threshold for union representation of more than 3 credits or 2 or more classes. The change is expanding that threshold from the more traditional academic year to the modern reality of our year-round higher educational opportunities. That, Mr. Chair and members, is what the bill is about. That is why I'm bringing the bill forward. And with your permission, Mr. Chair, I would like to turn it over to Mr. Jonathan Bowen from the Interfaculty Organization to provide further testimony as to why we should send this bill to the General Register.
Mr. Bowen, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jonathan Bowen, representing the Interfaculty Organization. We represent the approximately 4,000 professors, coaches, and counselors at the Minnesota State Universities. And in 1974, when POWER was first written, summer sessions in university level or college level were rare, and now they're a very normal part of a student's path to finishing their degree. There are approximately 84 faculty members that will be impacted by this, and they're all adjuncts. They all teach only in the summer, and so as long as they meet the minimum threshold that Representative Wogomoth had described of more than 3 credits, or more than 2 courses, they would be eligible to be represented by the bargaining unit. Currently, any faculty that teach only in the summer would not be eligible to be part of our bargaining unit, so when they call us about a concern or a grievance, we cannot help them, and we would just simply like to fix that.
Representative Robbins, did you wish to speak? Or?
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I just want to get my name on the list when he's finished.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So I'm interested to know, would adjunct faculty be required to participate, and what dues would they be paying?
Mr. Bunk?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Great question. So no, they would not be required to participate. Once they meet the threshold, they would have to choose to be a member of the union. However, once they meet the threshold, even if they don't choose to be a member of the union, we still represent them. So should they need some assistance or to file a grievance, we would still be required to help them. The dues for, we have a progressive dues structure. So it's 1.3% of base pay. So if you're teaching, as an adjunct, if you're teaching 3 credits, the dues annually would be $84.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so would they be required to pay the dues even if they elect not to be represented?
Bone.
Mr. Chair, no, they wouldn't.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I missed the total number of IFO members. If you could repeat that, and then also if you happen to know the anticipated cost to the MnState system for this change, even though it's only 84, if you happen to know.
Mr. Bone.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, the system has told us there's no cost. Currently, they are treating those summer faculty as though they're represented, so they're paying them. They're not providing all the benefits, but the cost that we have said is zero, or that they have told us is zero, and they're okay with this change. We worked on them with them on this language. The total number of faculty is 84. I don't have that broken out by bargaining unit, but I would assume it's about half for us and half for our two-year colleagues, MSCF.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you had just mentioned how many IFO members there are currently, and I realize apparently they're not all IFO, but that I missed that when you had said that. There was a little noise in here.
We have approximately 4,000. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. We have approximately 4,000 people that we represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all.
Any further questions? Mr. Bone, this would apply to adjunct faculty that teach in the fall and have done so for over 3 decades.
Mr. Chair, thankfully, those who teach only in the fall are already covered under current statute. This would actually expand it. So should that course be moved to the summer for some reason, you would still be eligible to be represented.
To hear that. Any further questions? Representative Clebar.
Thank you. Vice Chair Wolgamont, thank you for bringing the bill forward. I think it's an important bill. I don't think that we should have employees who are treated differently in the workplace, so I think this is really a good bill. And to the chair, should you decide that summers are your jam, maybe it would help you then as well. So, thank you very much.
Representative Cleburne, we are looking at expanding the model legislature program into the summer.
Oh, there you have it. Vote yes.
Any further questions, members? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like to make an oral amendment that we carve out those that teach in the fall.
the chair would call that amendment. Any further discussion? Representative Wolgamott.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to present this bill, and thank you, members, for the thoughtful discussion. Let's make sure that all of our faculty have the opportunity to be represented by a union, and I urge your support to send House File 1161 to the General Register.
Representative,
I'd like to renew my motion.
Amended.
As amended, yes.
Amended to the General Register. Representative Wolgamott renews his motion to send House File 1161 as amendment to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. And thank you both.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members.
Next bill on the agenda is House File 1789, Representative Hicks. And a reminder, members, we don't need to make any motion here. We are in possession of the bill, so we will be in possession of the bill until there is a decision made of what we are actually going to do with the bill, whether putting it as a solo bill or incorporating it into the omnibus bill. So, Representative Hicks, to your bill.
Thank you so much, Chair and members. Thank you so much for hearing this very important bill. I do have an author's amendment to move, Chair.
Please move your amendment.
I would like to move my author's amendment, which just gets it in the shape that the Office of Higher Ed would like it in.
All right. Is there any discussion to the amendment? Representative Scott.
Just for the record, Mr. Chair, that's the A1.
A1 amendment.
Thank you, Representative Scott.
Now, let's make sure we get the A1 amendment out. So, Representative Hicks, this comes at the request of the Office of Higher Ed?
Yes, Chair.
Do we have any more discussion other than that? It's just a clarifying amendment?
It's just a clarifying, just to get it in the shape I'd like.
Representative Robbins.
I have a question, Mr. Chair, on the amendment.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So I just want to make sure I'm understanding it, because the underlying bill says 500,000 in each year, and this says in addition to the base appropriation, these funds in the amendment are given to OHE for a grant program. So are you giving the money in the amendment to the general grant program and still a specific grant in the actual bill?
Representative Hicks.
Yes, thank you so much for the question. It is a one-time appropriation, and we would like to have it added to the base appropriation moving forward. Does that make
sense? Representative Robin.
It was previously a one-time appropriation, so this allows it to move forward.
So if I could just get a little more clarification, the amendment gives money to OHE for a grant program, but the bill gives money to a specific organization, so it's two separate things?
Representative Hicks.
I would like to phone a friend.
The Office of Higher Education?
Yes.
Yes. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Hello, Chair Pawlowski, members of the committee. My name is Megan Flores, and I serve as the manager of state financial aid programs for the Office of Higher Education. And I can speak to the amendment. So we're really grateful to come before you today with a success story and that this program exceeded our expectations. And with the base appropriation, it is not enough for us to meet the needs. We were really fortunate to not only award the full amount of the appropriation to all of our foster youth in Minnesota, but exceed that. And so this year we're running a shortfall already for the program. That is due in part to a partnership with foster advocates, with community members, and with our institutions. And a data share we were able to secure with the Department of Health and Human Services. And so we've avoided an application for students and streamlined the process. Given that we've had more students than we initially anticipated, we have 400 and I believe I have the number here. 459 students as of today are receiving funding through this appropriation. We're falling short by about 400,000 this academic year. Since it is a full cost of attendance program, and as we know, cost of attendance does increase each year, we are anticipating that we will continue to see that as the cost of attendance increases. So we would like an increase to the base appropriation so that we can cover the cost of the program for our fosters.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. That's super helpful. But just to clarify, the amendment money goes to a general grant program, and the bill goes to a specific nonprofit, or are they the same?
Ms. Flores.
They're actually two different things. The amendment for the grant program to the Office of Higher Education is specific to the Fostering Independence Higher Education Grants.
Thank you.
Further discussion to the amendment. Representative Cleburne.
I just want to say thank you for adding these additional funds. I think it's really important. When our students, when our fosters age out of the system, this is often very difficult. They don't have anyone else to fall back on. And these are life-changing dollars. So thank you so much for adding those to the bill. I appreciate it.
Further discussion to the amendment. Representative Mundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the record, this does change the base going forward from 500,000 to one in each year of the biennium to a total of 1.309 million. So it's an additional 309,000 going forward, I see, from what the base was. So just so we know what we're talking about.
Representative O'Neill, I think at the last hearing, the University of Minnesota may have set a record for that type of a change. So, any further discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted, and the bill should be in the order that the author wishes. And I think you have some testifiers you wish to bring up.
I do.
Okay.
I will just do a little overview. Chair and committee, I appreciate the opportunity to speak about this critically important issue, making sure that youth in foster care have the right to access high quality education and career opportunities and support. As many of you know, this is a passion area of mine as a foster parent. Foster youth should have the same access to post-secondary success. The amendment and what this body did in the previous session and what the amendment does talks about how to support them financially. The bill that I've brought before you as part of this is about more than just the success that money brings. It's about having support. Support that youth who have natural support networks already have. Think about all of your adult children who you have supported into their slingshot into adulthood. Helping them understand where they can get health care, how to get a copy of their insurance card, where they can find resources, how to buy car insurance, how to budget their money when they've maybe overspent a bit. Many times youth in foster care are lacking those solid support networks, that person to call when the unexpected occurs. They may have had multiple placements over their youth or their teen years. And we all know how important it is to learn those life skills to be successful in college. Many youth do not have that trusted person they can call. They may have transitioned out of foster care without a formal forever family. They need someone that they can reach out to if they do not know how to do those life tasks. If they have a question or they need to bounce an idea off of someone. This bill provides support for Foster Advocates, which is an important nonprofit that is elevating many of these issues affecting our young people in foster care. They are committed to supporting all fosters through their Foster Success Program. They're grounded, most importantly, in the voices of our foster youth. With this appropriation, they can expand their model statewide to provide Minnesota fosters with ongoing tailored support and coaching services, ensure youth have the opportunity to maximize all of their available resources, such as the Fostering Independence Program, and get on a pathway that makes sense for them. This would create a space for fosters to truly focus on their education and aspirations. This type of wraparound service is what's needed for true success. Fosters face significant barriers at many, many points of their experience into adulthood, but especially during the critical time of trying to access higher education. We know that fosters have the lowest high school graduation rates, the highest incidences of homelessness, and multiple school disruptions without adults to support them through those challenges. But I could talk to you all day long about why this is passionate for me. I would rather turn it over to my testifiers, who are the real experts here, to talk about why this program matters so much for our fosters.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for having me today. My name is Ariana Guerra. I am the Director of Systems Change at Foster Advocates. I will keep my testimony very brief because we have two amazing testifiers here with us today. But before I pass it over, I want to start with a quick moment of celebration. It was 2 years ago on this very day where the very first hearing on the Fostering Higher Education Act was held. It is powerful to be back here today and share with you all that since fall of 2022, over 465 Minnesota fosters have benefited from this grant. That is over $2 million that we have invested in fosters in our state. And yes, we know that was only the first step, but today, with your support of House File 1789, we can take the next big step for fosters and provide the necessary wraparound services they need to be successful. This program is valuable, and the time to provide these interventions is now. In 2021, 83% of Minnesota's general population students graduated from high school in the traditional four-year track. Meanwhile, only 37% of their foster peers were able to achieve the same success. Fosters rank lower than all other demographic breakdowns in our state, including young people experiencing homelessness. They are statistically less likely to graduate high school than all of their peers. There are many fosters who wish to graduate high school and even more who wish to pursue higher education, but there are significant barriers that prevent them from doing so. In fact, studies have found that only 3% of fosters will successfully obtain a four-year college degree. It is yet another unfortunate statistic. As a foster myself, I was lucky. I had a safety net. Despite everything else, I had access to a great education in southern Minnesota, and I had folks supporting me along the way. The reality, though, is that most fosters do not have this person in their lives, but this program allows us to be. We are grateful for the Fostering Higher Education Act and the equity it has provided for our community. We are also grateful for the collaboration between our organization and the Office of Higher Education. Together, we work to get this off the ground and get fosters onto their own education pathways. It truly is a great example of how a state agency and community partner can and should work together. With that, I will let Shane and Vivian take it from here. Our Executive Director, Wong Murphy, and I are available for any questions. Thank you.
All right. So who's, is it Shane Reed that's next? Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. Chair members and committee, my name is Shane Reed. I am 25 years old. I currently reside in Bemidji, Minnesota, with my amazing partner and our new baby. I'm a part-time student at Bemidji State University, pursuing a degree in sociology. I'm here today to share my education journey and the need for House File 1789. Excuse me. Thank you for allowing me the chance to advocate for many fosters who don't have a voice or just haven't found it yet. My foster journey began when I was 11 years old in southern Minnesota. Since fifth grade, I moved to a school every single year, sometimes two. Foster care brings a lot of different whirlwinds of emotions, and the instability in my story has affected me to this day. Like many fosters, my school was a safe haven. It was one place that I could get away from all of my problems. It was difficult being the new kid, the foster kid, so I never really had any friends. I stood out like a sore thumb. It was difficult to live a normal life because I was always an outsider in one way or another. When I was 17, the topic of college came up for the first time with my social worker. I rarely thought about graduation or life after high school. I knew I wasn't prepared for college, but I felt the push to go anyway. At this time in my life, I didn't care about my story, and I was a pretty ignorant 17-year-old. But when I asked questions or tried to make a real plan, there was no one there to support me. What were my options if higher education was not for me? In my research, I considered a lot of different schools, and I landed at Bemidji State. I didn't have a blueprint or a roadmap for success. However, my advisor was the first person to help me, and I know that she did the best that she could. I was struggling to navigate it all from the beginning, and I didn't know who to ask. I didn't know who to ask for help or even how to. All at once, excuse me, I had aged out of foster care, I lost my housing, and I was failing at school. My world was crashing all around me. I was placed on academic warning, probation, and then again academic suspension. I took a break and focused on me, knowing that one day I would try again. It wasn't until the fall of 2022 that this day finally came for me. I finally felt I had the support I needed to be successful. I had my partner Salem, and I had the support of foster advocates. Now I'm back at school, and I am no longer homeless. It feels amazing. But I wouldn't be lying if I said this was easy. I put all of my energy into my appeal so I could go back to school, and it was immediately denied. I don't think anyone has ever really prepared to stand in front of strangers who know nothing about you or your story, but hold the fate of your future in your hands. But I had been here before many times. As a foster, others have always had my fate in their hands. I knew I wasn't prepared initially, but now I was. Didn't I deserve another chance? I am thankful for the guidance and advocacy from the staff at Foster Advocates. Everyone there offered me support all along the way and wrote letters of support, and my appeal was approved. Looking back, it would have meant the world to me to have this support earlier on. I can't tell you how many times I've wanted someone like that in my life and how many times my advisor tried to be that person but couldn't understand what I was trying to say. Thanks to the Fostering Higher Education Act, for the first time, my future is looking bright. I want this for all fosters, early on. Please support fosters by supporting House File 1789. Thank you.
Representative Hicks, Vivian Dudley is next. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Vivian Dudley.
Proceed, go ahead.
Chair members of the committee, thank you for allowing me the chance to speak before
Ms. Dudley, you.
Ms. Dudley,
you might want to sit and speak into the mic so we can hear you better. Okay. Thank you.
Chair members and committees, thank you for allowing me to speak the chance to speak before you today. My name is Vivian Dudley. I am 25 years old, and I'm here to speak to the value and the need of the HF 1789. I'm a proud child of God, a foster, and a survivor. I have wished to become a social worker since I was 8 years old. And finally, I can say I am on my way to doing just that. I'm a student at St. Paul College, and next year I'll be transferring to St. Kate's. I look forward to the chance of being a light in the life of others the way so many have been for me. Visits from child protection have been a constant in my life from the age of 5. It wasn't until I turned 16 that I had officially entered foster care. Growing up in school and mental health treatment centers were the only safe place for me. I know a lot of people don't want to be there, but I wanted to be. I had people to talk to, they gave me an ear, and the surrogate love that I really needed. I loved school, and it was the only one place I could be my full organic self. I was in advanced classes through middle school. I loved to read and learn about history. Middle school was up and down for me due to my attention-seeking behaviors. I was suspended and had a lot of trauma, and it was interfering with my education. I wore a mask, but that behavior still came out in different ways. My sophomore year of high school, I finally entered foster care in Anoka County. I was also pregnant, so my options for placement were limited. I was immediately placed at the detention center in Lino Lakes as a result. I felt so ashamed, and it was difficult to accept it all. I didn't feel human, and I couldn't understand normalcy. I couldn't understand why I had to pay for what others had done to me. How did I end up here? I had a daughter, so now I found refuge in my education and kept my grades up. I did everything I could because I wanted to get her back and build a life that my daughter needed and deserved. The moment I entered foster care, I simply couldn't see a future for myself. I was struggling just to make it and to have visitations with my daughter. Unfortunately, I never was given a chance to be a mother. After that experience and being so institutionalized, I finally ran away for the first time in my life. It wasn't until the last year at age 24 that college became a reality for me again. I had reconnected with a supportive adult in my journey, and he told me about the Foster and Higher Education Act. To hear that there was an opportunity like this, especially for fosters, was a shock and came exciting at the same time. I finally had a chance again in life. It had always been just a dream and a thought. I immediately applied to college and I was accepted. I had no idea what to do or to prepare or where even to expect. I knew that the costs were covered, yes, but I didn't understand what that really meant. I didn't understand the ins and outs of financial aid, and I lacked the confidence to move forward. Looking back, I was so unprepared and so lost. My primary focus was just ensuring my basic needs were being met. Although I'm still taking things day by day, I'm grateful for the folks at OHE, for their technical support and for them connecting with Hannah at Foster Advocates. She really helped me figure it all out. I think a lot of people really don't know what foster care does to you until they go through it. If I had support like Foster Success early on, I know I would have already been a social worker and doing what God wanted me to do sooner. I feel like a lot of things would have come sooner. Although this will be the last year for me to tap into the Foster and Higher Education Act, I am so grateful. I know this is not the end, but it's just the beginning for me and so many other fosters. It might be a different face, but it's the same voice. It might be a different place, but it's the same pain. I want all fosters to have the support to overcome these barriers. The hardest part of being in foster care was being alone and feeling isolated. I always felt like I wasn't seen, and fosters really know they are seen. There is light at the end of the tunnel. Help is here, and with your support of FH 1789, we can really make this a reality for so many others. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair and members. I really hope that we can support this initiative. Our youth in foster care are our responsibility, and we need to support and ensure that they launch successfully. Thank you so much.
So members, just as a reminder, these bills are in possession of the committee. These numbers could change, and it depends on the target. They could go up or they could go down depending on the target and the priorities. So the bill as it is in our possession. Thank you, Representative Hicks. Next on the agenda is, oh wait, did you have a question? Sorry.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Oh, Representative Hicks, if you wouldn't mind. Oh, it's fine. First of all, thank you for bringing this bill. I do support what you're doing, and I really appreciate it, and I appreciate the testimony. It was really powerful. I do have a couple questions about the bill says it's a one-time appropriation. So what are the other sources of funding for this organization?
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. I will have their executive director come up and explain their funding.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Wong Murphy.
Proceed.
Yep. And so you were asking about other sources of funding. We have a really diverse sources of funding, largely through foundations and private philanthropic dollars.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so one-time appropriation is just to sort of jumpstart something or add staff, or why is this a one-time appropriation?
Mr. Murphy.
Yeah, I really appreciate that question. You know, I think that it's really important that nonprofits are able to stand up on their own eventually, but this is a first time that, you know, the fostering independence grants have ever been, you know, sent out or even trialed. Minnesota went from a state that did practically nothing for foster youth to a state that is now the, you know, the one that does the very most of any others. In fact, last week, California introduced a bill to mirror ours. And I think that's really critical. But what we lack here in the state is an infrastructure that supports fosters getting to and through college. While FIG is amazing, while it provides an opportunity for young people who are in foster care to go to school, we know that there is a melt and a loss. When you turn 18, if you turn 18 in the spring, then you are effectively homeless until you go to college. But we know that young people then don't make it. And so what this one-time appropriation is going to be used for is to then support our programs to expand statewide so that young people don't have to just be lucky and be in a specific county or be near another nonprofit that just happens to do that work, because we do not hold county contracts or state contracts that are geographically specific in greater Minnesota. We'd love to then not have any bias towards geography in delivering those services. What we'd also like to use those funds for is then supporting the colleges that are participating. Currently, that's 66, and make sure that they can then build the infrastructure as well, because ultimately they need to support students who have been in foster care without any outside help. But it will take us a little bit of time to get to that space, and we are confident that we can get there eventually, but that's why we're seeking funds from the state now. Thank you.
Representative Rum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. It's very helpful, and I think those are all great goals. And Representative Hicks, I have a side project that I'm very focused on working with the OLA on grants management in this state. And so I would like to, working with you, go forward a little bit about some reporting requirements. Generally, the OLA does not support named individual grants, and they're working to help us as a body address that. So if you'd like to have some offline conversation about that, I would love to include that in it. But I strongly support what you're doing. I think it's an excellent addition to what the state has been trying to do. And I would just like to make sure it's as tight and buttoned up as possible. Thank you.
Representative Hicks, you want to respond?
Thank you for that. I'd love to have an offline conversation.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Hicks. I just want to say hello to all the foster youth here. We worked on the Foster Ombudsperson Bill last year, so these are a lot of the kids who continue to step forward, to continue to talk about why we need to keep investing in you. So I just want to say good job. I'm proud of you, and this is what being the change you want to see in the world looks like. So thank you for being here, everyone.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hicks, for bringing this forward. And I just wanted to give a shout out to Ms. Dudley and her testimony, a very moving testimony. And it's, you're going to make a great social worker. And you understand, you have this calling, right? You feel like God has called you into that. And so that's going to be blessed. And I thank you for your willingness to be brave and stand up and testify in front of us. You did a great job. We all put our pants on one leg at a time, just like you do. And you felt, it looked like you were a little nervous at first, but you got easier as you told your story. And I just really appreciate you coming forward today.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I apologize. I was actually trying to look up your 990 and your annual report, all of which, Representative Hicks, you should have probably provided when we're talking about a brand new nonprofit organization that's never received state funding before. Those are just standard things that we do here at the legislature. I worked in the field of nonprofit for about 20 years, doing compliance, accounting, auditing, traveling around the world, all kinds of different things. But I can't find their 990 easily. It's not connected to their website. And when I looked at their three-year report and then the last report from 2021, it was very thin with financial information. And listen, I used to create those documents, so I know how to read them and what to look for. So my concern is that we don't have any of that information in front of me, and we should. We should absolutely have their 990. We should have their annual report. And they do have it's more of an overview than a three-year annual report. Again, those are reports I've actually created multiple times in the past in my profession. So in the annual report of 2021, it says that 84% of the annual revenue coming in was from foundations, 12% from individuals, and 4% for contracts. And in the 2021 report, it said they currently have 5 staff, and it said it didn't even say revenue. It said that $460,000 came from donors. So there wasn't a total revenue even on their annual reports. So if we're going to move this forward, Mr. Chair, I would really ask that, and it should have been really provided in this committee, in this hearing, just like any other, when we ask the University of Minnesota or anything else. So we need their 990, we need their full annual report with actual numbers, because they just started in 2018. They've never had state funding that I can find before. According to their 2021 annual report, 84% of their funding came from foundations. So while it might be a great project, I have no idea, because I can't analyze their financials. And I should at least be able to see their 990. And that's not connected to their website. So if we're going to do our due diligence here, we need to be provided with the correct information. And I literally spent half the hearing trying to find it. And I went through as much as was on the website. I didn't see a link to the 990, which should have been there. So, Mr. Chair, I asked.
The bill is in possession of the committee. We can certainly get that information. And Representative Hicks, I'm sure, would be happy to provide it. So we have time to get it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's really important, especially as we rarely around here do direct appropriations to a nonprofit, and this is a brand new nonprofit that we'd be giving to. So I'm a little disappointed this morning in what was provided.
Representative O'Neill, this is just the first step. We have a long way to go.
Fair enough, sir.
Representative Colter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my thunder has been stolen a little bit by Representative Hansen and Representative Scott, but I just briefly wanted to thank the testifiers and all of the folks who showed up this morning. This can be, excuse me, a really intimidating space, even for those of us who have been around for a while. And to have you all here and telling your story so powerfully is just really, really inspiring. So I wanted to thank you for doing that. And also state for the record that I'm really happy that there are cute babies in the audience with us.
Okay. Representative Clevar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have two comments. One is just to you. If we're asking nonprofits for their 990s, I would just like to make the request that we get Fairview's and we get Sanford's, okay? Because that would be great information for us to have. Now, back to the bill before us. To Shane and to Vivian, as a former guardian for CHIPS, I just want to say I see you. I know how difficult the journeys that you have walked have been. And Shane, when you said to have your life in the hands of people who don't know you, I've sat in those rooms where 15 adults argued over what is best for the child, and as the guardian keeps saying, have you talked to the child? Have you talked to the child? So your trauma, your experience has been incredible, and to see you here today testifying before the legislature, both of you, truly amazing. Vivian, your comment about loving school and both of you saying that's a safe space. School is the only place that I ever knew that fosters were able to feel like kids. And so I think it's really incumbent upon the state to help you receive all of the education. And fosters are children of the state. You are our children. So just as we as individuals care for our children, we as the state must care for you. And I want to thank Foster Advocates for your incredible work. I know the journeys that you've shared with me as well. It takes, I mean, even the questions you've been asked in this committee, right? You're running this journey by yourself with nobody who's experienced this before you, and you're carving this path anew by yourself. Please know that we here at the legislature, many of us are here to support you in this endeavor and to work again to advocate for you and for the community that you're bringing with you. So thank you for bringing this bill. Thank you for sharing your incredible stories. And I personally apologize for the trauma that you have faced through your years, your innocent children. And I look forward to partnering with you as we go forward. Thank you.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, everyone, for hearing this and for keeping it in our possession to have a further dialogue and conversation. I wish that this wasn't the first time that fostering advocacy had grant funds. I wish that we had a state system that took care of youth after the age of 18. I wish that extended foster care, when it ended at 21, wasn't a huge cliff that left people with no support network and no one to call when they buy their first house and don't know how to fix the plumbing. I wish all of those things weren't true. But they are, and many of those things are not part of the purview of this committee, but it is a passion of my life to make sure that all children, especially those that have been put in foster care, have what they need to launch into adulthood just like everyone else. So I appreciate your time, your thoughtful conversation, and the dialogue today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Next on the agenda, House File 165, Representative Cole. I don't see it. Representative Coulter, to your bill.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, to begin with, stop me if you've heard this before, but I'm here today to talk about an enrollment decline. instead of talking about specific colleges or universities, though, we're talking about folks becoming paramedics. You all have in your packets a handout detailing the challenges that are facing emergency medical services in Minnesota. And the number that I want to specifically draw your attention to is on the back. Nearly 3,000 more EMS provider certifications expired than were issued. House File 165 specifically deals with paramedics, but it's a similar story. Barely half as many graduates took the paramedic exam compared to the number of certifications that have expired. House File 165 takes aim at part of that issue by establishing a paramedic scholarship program administered by the Office of Higher Education. This would be funded by a one-time appropriation of $3.2 million, with $3 million of that going to up to 600 scholarships for an average scholarship of $5,000. So with that, I will turn to my testifiers who can speak more directly to the need for this bill.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, Buck McAlpin on behalf of the Minnesota Ambulance Association. Thanks to Representative Coulter for carrying this bill. Again, as I look at some folks like Representative Davids and Representative Pawlowski, our ambulance industry would be in a lot dire consequences without the long-term support of this state legislature. We have some of the highest Medicaid rates in the country. This group's always stepped up over the years to fund us. We were working before COVID, Mr. Chair and members, in a rural sustainability committee as we saw this decline starting to happen. Old paramedics like me with gray hair that were just leaving the profession, And we worked pretty hard on solutions, and we're coming up with ideas. And then COVID hit, which, as you've probably heard in other committees, has really impacted the EMS community. It's sad to say there's probably parts of the state today we probably have a hard time of an ambulance even responding to someone's call appropriately, where some of our volunteer services are. So our statute changes over the years on the EMS regulatory board have allowed us to use part-time paramedics, bring very advanced medical care to rural Minnesota and not only to large communities. And besides, there's two levels of practitioners, emergency medical technicians. We have legislation also to fund that. Right now there's a program through the regulatory board to reimburse for that training and for some first responder training. And the paramedic side is one we have to focus on too. And we thought for sure we'd bring this. We did bring it forward last year and had good hearings at the end of session that didn't get done. But as we look at what I think Mr. Ferguson will come up next from the regulatory board and talk about, is we have to have some real significant discussions around funding to try to get folks in. Many of the smaller ambulance services, or even some of the large ones, are offering these grants out of their budgets now that most of them are operating in the red, trying to pay even for people in internship programs to become paramedics across the state. The community college up by Moorhead just canceled their community paramedic program. Out of 30 open slots, they only had two people apply for it. And that's a little concerning as we look about what we think people should have access to is an ambulance, police officer, sheriff, or fire department that shows up in an appropriate time. So we appreciate your support from this statewide, from our association and Representative Coulter. And if Mr. Ferguson could come up and talk about some of the data, I think it's pretty interesting as they've worked hard to really identify the problems for us.
Right. Mr. Ferguson, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Chair Pawlowski. My name is Dylan Ferguson, Executive Director for the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board. As an EMT for the last 18 years and a paramedic for the last 13, I know the importance of making investments into the emergency medical services workforce in helping to ensure an adequate pipeline of individuals interested in a career in emergency medical services. Over the course of the last year, the MSRB has been working closely with a variety of different stakeholders, including the Ambulance Association and legislators, to try to identify strategies to reverse a worrying trend within EMS, with professionals leaving at a rate exceeding what they can be replaced, as the fine representative had highlighted. EMS is an intricate system of different levels of providers, ranging from community-based EMRs that take a 48-hour course to EMTs that take a 180-hour course, all the way to the level that we're talking about today of paramedics, which take over 1,000 hours of training over the course of 1 to 2 years. These individuals undergo training in administering numerous medications and advanced clinical procedures to wherever they are needed outside of a hospital's walls in Minnesota. As of today, there are a total of 3,827 paramedics to go around the entire state of Minnesota. Of that being said, only about 80% of them are actively practicing clinical medicine in the back of an ambulance. So as a result, paramedics are in heavy demand, both in metropolitan areas, but also, as Mr. McAlpin had mentioned, in outstate Minnesota. But the demand for these highly trained, qualified, and credentialed practitioners far outpaces the available supply. Much is what we have seen both in cases of nursing and nursing assistants, which we have seen some previous scholarship legislation that had significant positive impacts. It's my hope that Senate File 159, that the bill before you today of House File 165 will serve as one tool in a toolbox that needs to continue to grow even beyond the bill before you today, but is a wonderful step in the right direction and is also a step towards helping us ensure that the diversity of our EMS workforce is reflective to the communities which they serve. In 2015, EMS education programs across Minnesota created 160 new paramedics. For calendar year 2022, that number fell to 125 new paramedics, which means a 22% decrease in the number of paramedics that we were able to create within our own borders here within Minnesota. Complicating this fact, when it comes to paramedics deciding to leave the field, from 2018 to 2021, on average, 190 let their certification expire for each of those years. So at a simplified level, every year we lose 65 more paramedics than what we're able to replace. Most concerningly, 50% who let their certification expire are under the age of 40 years old, and a staggering 20% are under the age of 30. The inability to recruit more paramedics and to retain younger paramedics leads to workforce challenges and a workforce that increases in age each year. And presently, nearly a quarter of all of our certified paramedics in the state are over the age of 50. As written, this bill would help remove one of the largest barriers of EMTs from upgrading their skills and their certification: cost. With over 1,000 hours worth of material and activity to cover, the costs of education have increased, just as it seems the cost of everything has gone up each year. It's also important to note that EMTs, from where our paramedics come from, are also one of the lowest paid, when they're paid at all, when it comes to healthcare professionals. In fact, one-third of all EMTs who left the profession reported pay and compensation being an influential factor to their premature departure. With all this being the case, it's not difficult to assess why they're not advancing to the paramedic level. House File 165 would help remove some of those barriers and allow our emergency medical technicians to be able to upgrade their skills and fill an ever-increasing need across the state without wondering how to pay for that associated training. It's for all these reasons that I ask for your support and consideration for holding over House File 165 for inclusion in the omnibus. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ferguson, how does Minnesota compare on their training and qualifications for EMTs versus EMS with other states? It seems a complaint that I get from a lot of my constituents that are in this field is that the demands are just so amazing. I don't know, very restrictive, very tough. And I want my EMT to be very well trained, believe me. I'm not saying that, but how do we compare with surrounding states on number of hours, qualifications, things like that?
Mr. Ferguson.
Mr. Chair, as it relates to Minnesota's qualifications for those courses, I'll address at the emergency medical technician level. Minnesota uses the National EMS Education Standards, which are promulgated by the Office of Emergency Medical Services within the National Highway Transportation and Safety Administration as a part of an interdisciplinary group. And then for their credentialing point of view, all of our EMTs take what is referred to as the National Registry of Emergency Medical Technicians examination. This is a pathway which is utilized at the EMT level, I believe, by 44 of the 50 states. The other aspect that I feel it's really important to highlight is because we use those national EMS education standards, there is no longer a minimum number of hours, Representative. It used to be that courses, no matter how they were ran, an EMT class had to be 120 hours, period, full stop. There is now a utilization of more of a competency-based approach where there's a list of competencies, and if a program can complete it in 180 hours versus 160 hours versus 200 hours, it can really be tailored by that program to the needs of their specific community. But the other thing that I will also highlight is the number of hours has gone up time over time, and that is really twofold. The first relates to expectations from the community. As we take a look at TV shows, like for some of you growing up may have remembered an old show called Emergency, which covered the antics of a firefighter paramedics, Johnny and Roy, out of LA County, Squad 51. to even more recent shows such as Night Watch, which covers, you know, New Orleans EMS. And the public sees these advanced skills on TV, and that is what their expectation is now, right, wrong, or indifferent, of when an ambulance arrives. The what we would refer to generally as a scope of practice for an EMT has significantly expanded over the course of the last 20 years. Here in Minnesota, we do not have a state-defined scope of practice. Those decisions are made at a local level by individual EMS agency medical directors. However, even our EMTs are providing more medications and providing more interventions than at any time in Minnesota, or really it can be equally applied across the country. From a paramedic perspective, I can apply most of the same logic. The only thing that changes, Mr. Chair, would be the fact that I believe it is 48 states utilize the same methodology and the required accreditation from the Committee on Accreditation for the EMS profession. So that would be my answer, and I hope that that's a sufficient explanation, Representative Davids.
Well, David,
thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that answer. That was very helpful. We have a crisis here in EMS, EMTs, and it's very, very severe. And Mr. McAlpin has been in my office many times trying to figure out this out. I've been working on this since the mid-80s as mayor of a small town, and since I entered the legislature in 91, I have worked on it over the years with Roger Cooper and Representative Pawlowski and others. This is a very serious, serious thing. This is one thing I think we could do to help, but there are other things we need to do too. For example, in several of my tax bills, I put tax credits in to give stipends, additional signing bonuses to folks that will sign up for EMT classes. We're trying to think outside the box, and this doesn't solve everything, but I think this really helps. And I want to thank Representative Coulter for this, and I know with Representative Pawlowski and I going to our Tri-County Firefighters meetings in the Southeast, we are in a crisis mode right now. And I'm hoping, Mr. Chair, that, you know, this is being laid over, but I'm hoping we can work on this and other issues to help our EMS service. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Ferguson, Representative Coulter, I have a concern in Section 2, lines 2.21 to 2.29. Can you explain how these numbers were arrived at? The 3.2 million is a overall number, and then the breakdown. Mr. Ferguson.
So I in taking a look at, and I wasn't directly involved with the crafting of this legislation, but in just reviewing, if I may, Representative, in reviewing the language, when we took a look at what the tuition of different paramedic programs are across the state for just a base, as a base, not including some of the prerequisites which may be required, we were finding that those scholarships were in the area of $5,000, right? So that was the kind of average tuition across the state. In trying to jumpstart some of this, the goal, it looks like, was to try to identify, you know, up to 600 students for the 24-25 biennia. So when you took that 600 multiplying by that maximum $5,000 scholarship, looking at what that need was, that's how it appears that base of 3 million was established. And obviously we recognize that the Office of Higher Ed, in order for them to administer this program, that certainly there's going to be some costs in making sure that, you know, scholarships are awarded in the manner consistent with the statute, and making sure that all reporting requirements and all fiscal requirements, because obviously from previous questions of this committee, that's something that's very, very important. And then lastly, it's important, it's going to be a requirement to try to make people aware of this program, right? Because if there is not if there isn't an awareness of the program, or trying to encourage people, our current EMTs, to upgrade and take that paramedic course, then that would just basically be money that would have been set aside for no good reason. It would go unused and would ultimately lapse back to the general fund, which is something that we really want to avoid. We want this program to do a lot of good. So, Mr. Chair, in reviewing those amounts in Section 2, that is how I would identify that those came to be.
with the specification that those fundings that funds has to be expended by June 30 of 2026 or when those funds were exhausted, whichever would occur first, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Ferguson, I appreciate the explanation because I share the concern of Representative Davids in the regard to how this program is going to work. We are in a desperate situation here across the state, and I'm hopeful that you picked the correct numbers and the correct approach. So I appreciate the bill a great deal. My concern is always over how these numbers are selected, and I would hope that it would work. Representative Scott, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just curious, based on the testimony about the pay that our emergency medical folks receive, is there going to be enough incentive for this program if the pay is not that great on the other side if they complete
Mr. Ferguson.
The program?
Mr. Chair, as it relates, and this is that is actually a wonderful question, Representative, and it is also somewhat part of a challenge. So with having different levels of expertise within the EMS system, EMRs, EMTs, paramedics, different reimbursement rates for ambulance services based on whether advanced life support care is provided or basic life support is provided. There are different salaries for an EMT or a paramedic. A paramedic will typically make a little bit more than an emergency medical technician, yet current salary kind of tracking both by Minnesota DEED and also the U.S. Department of Labor kind of collapses both EMTs and paramedics into the same pay structure. So I can tell you that I would say that on average an EMT is probably looking south of $30,000 a year, and a paramedic, looking back at probably 2018 data, you're probably more in the neighborhood of $30,000 to $40,000. So there would be somewhat of a financial incentive for someone to promote from being an EMT to a paramedic. However, when you are responsible for paying for that education for yourself, it is very difficult for them to be able to make that investment in themselves on the salary that they're currently making, particularly if they're already, as I did growing up in Illinois' EMS system, I had to work part-time for 9 different ambulance services to put myself both through paramedic school and also complete my undergraduate. So this is a case where I believe if we would remove that financial barrier from the individual student and try to remove that financial barrier from the employers that they currently work for, who really do not have those extra funds, particularly in the outstate, to be able to support those educational ventures, I do think that there would be that incentive to do so. I think there are a lot of EMTs that this is just a barrier for them, both from a cost perspective and also from a time perspective of just making sure that they're able to provide for themselves and their family. Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
I guess one of the questions that pops into my mind based on what you just said was, and maybe you have a breakdown of this, you have a really good grasp of all the data inside of your head, which is awesome. How many of the EMTs in Minnesota right now, if you know, are only part-time? How many of them are full-time with the definition being maybe they're working more than one part-time? Maybe they're working two part-time gigs to make the equivalent of a full-time. So what I'm getting at here is, you know, $30,000 to $40,000 a year isn't going to get you much in most areas of the state as far as a standard of living.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like in outstate, for instance, it would be much harder to have more than one part-time gig as a paramedic because there's probably only one provider in town. So you kind of get what I'm getting at.
I do, and that is, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Ferguson.
My apologies, Mr. Chair. Caught myself, but barely. So as it relates specifically to the question of having a full-time or a part-time breakdown, unfortunately, those are not statistics that are currently, collected by the EMS Regulatory Board. It's not part of our data set. But what we take a look at, though, is we have somewhat of a breakdown of volunteer providers versus combination in employers of maybe they pay some people but they volunteer others, or versus all volunteer organizations. And one of the things that we've noticed is year over year, the number of services and the amount of transports that are having to be covered more by paid employers or by all paid EMS agencies does continue to stay somewhere in that 79% to 80% of volume. The number of all volunteer organizations continued to decline. And speaking to the point of, you know, there may not be that many places to be able to work, there are certainly several EMS providers who will travel from, you know, one side of a county to the other side of a county. If they're not already working, you know, 20, 30, 40, 60 hours of overtime to ensure that all the ambulances that are needed with a community are staffed. So I don't have the exact figure that you're looking for, but that is what I would offer as a substitute that I do have, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott. Okay, thank you. Mr. Ferguson, this is for students entering the program. Is there something available for current EMTs that could help them offset certification costs that are already in the system?
Mr. Chair, at the EMT, at the emergency medical technician level, the answer to that question is yes. The Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board administers a program in which we can provide reimbursements for their continuing education courses. However, the existing statute is very strict. It only allows us to provide that reimbursement to what are referred to as volunteer ambulance attendants. So they essentially can't make more than, I believe it's somewhere in the neighborhood of somewhere between $6,000 and $8,000. If they make over that, or if they're at any other level other than an EMT, they do not qualify. We have been trying to work with other legislators and other committees to potentially look at expanding that program to allow, you know, an increase to those amounts that are currently reimbursed, because they have not kept up with the cost of education, as they haven't been addressed probably since the late 90s or early 2000s. And as I said, it's restricted only to that EMT level. So really, there really is no state assistance once you have departed that EMT level. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Ferguson, I've just got one follow-up. Which committee would be in charge of that account?
Those types of bills, Mr. Chair, would likely be the jurisdiction of the House Health Policy and Finance Committee, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief follow-up. I like this bill, and we can work the numbers and make sure that they work. But like I said, it's very, very serious right now. We have, and this is not this bill, but we have situations across the state, especially in rural Minnesota, where the infrastructure for ambulance buildings, and that's not for today, they're crumbling. They're crumbling. And I have several bills that we'll be looking at in the tax committee to allow communities to basically sales taxes for the communities for ambulance buildings, because they're very, very important, because we really have to watch out that communities don't start coming to the legislature for bonding for these buildings, because if we start doing that, we're going to be building 900 ambulance sheds, and I don't think we want to go there on the bonding side. But again, I support this bill. Mr. McAlpin, thank you for everything you do here, and to Mr. Ferguson, I wish you had your facts a little more in order.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the sense of humor.
Mr. Chair, for the record, that was, as my grandson would say, Grandpa, is I won't tell you what he says.
Now you know.
Yes, now you know. So no, you're amazing testimony, and I really appreciate it. Oh, he said, Grandpa, is that sarcasm? 8 years old. Is that sarcasm? I say, yes. Sam, that's okay.
Representative Coulter, we're in possession of the bill, and should you need to change those numbers, let us know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that actually was the exact point that I was going to make. So I'm happy to continue that conversation with other legislators, with OHE, about what the exact numbers look like. I think
and Mr. Ferguson, you should let some of us know on the progress of those other bills. We would find we offer support.
I thank you for your support, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Next on the agenda is, and last on the agenda, is House File 1435, Representative Bang, the College Possible Bill. Representative Bang, I don't think there's an amendment, so I think we're just taking the bill straight up. All right, Representative Bang, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1435 is a appropriation for College Possible. College Possible was established in the year 2000. It supports students across the state from low-income backgrounds with college applications, admission, persistence, and graduation. They also serve students from junior year of high school through the completion of bachelor's degree, no matter how long it takes. Currently, they are serving about 5,500 high school and college students across Minnesota. And one of the reasons why I'm happy to carry this bill is because I'm I've benefited from College Possible. Being a first-generation graduate, I would not have been able to understand the process of applying for college without the help of my College Possible coach. And they were the ones that were able to help me apply to colleges that I would never have thought of applying in the first place. So much gratitude to the work and mission of College Possible, and I'm happy to answer any questions, and I'll yield the rest of my time to my testifier.
All right, your first testifier, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Paula Cashton. I'm the Director of Institutional Engagement at College Possible. And we also, I just want to point out Xavier Allen Knight, one of our AmeriCorps coaches, and Benjamin Tao, another one of our coaches, and also a program alumni. As Representative Vang said, and thank you so much for your sponsorship, College Possible provides direct student supports to students from their junior year of high school through the completion of a bachelor's degree, no matter how long that takes. Our direct services are delivered by AmeriCorps members who are recent college graduates and rigorously trained as near-peer college access and success coaches, with programming happening both remotely and in person, and in both group and individual settings. We support all aspects of the college journey, including college applications, selection and enrollment, financial aid and scholarships applications, financial literacy, microscholarships and emergency funding, navigation of college academics and campus resources, career readiness, social emotional skills, and community building. We are currently serving students from 45 high schools and at 54 colleges and universities across the state. Our students are 93% BIPOC, 90% are or will be the first in their families to graduate from college. Our students are all free or reduced priced lunch eligible in high school with an average annual household income of $35,000. And we support students with GPAs in high school of above 2.0. We intentionally focus on all students interested in college, not just those who are highest achieving while in high school. And all of our services are free to students. So a little bit about our outcomes. Of our 2022 high school graduates, 87% enrolled in college in the following fall, compared to 61% statewide for all students and 45% statewide for students from low-income backgrounds. In the last academic year, 87% of our first-year college students persisted on to their second year, compared to 75% nationally for students from all income backgrounds. First to second year persistence is a key predictor of eventual college completion. And our most 6-year graduation rates show 57% of our students graduating from college, compared to 60% nationally for students from all income levels, putting our students on par with those from all income levels. Thank you so much, and I will now turn it to my colleague, Isaiah Allen.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Paula. Thank you, Representative Vang. My name is Isaiah Allen. I'm the Senior Director of External Relations for College Possible Minnesota. Paula shared with you briefly the statistics about our program and the impact that it has. Let me speak briefly to the larger impact of this or of the work that we do across the state of Minnesota. So College Possible is partnering in addressing the state and university enrollment decline issue in that we address the degree divide through our robust partnerships with the universities across the state. We support in the recruitment, enrollment, and retention efforts of our partners across the state of Minnesota. This is especially important for low-income students as we move out of the most intense aspect of the most intense fallout from the COVID pandemic and the disruption caused by the pandemic in higher education. We've seen that for low-income students, the rebound in returning to higher education has been the slowest. College Possible also addresses the economic inequalities as a college degree is a reliable pathway for ongoing stability, both for individual households and for entire communities. And finally, we respond to the established need for a professional workforce that is more representative of our diverse state population, while also supporting Minnesota's standing as a destination for businesses looking to attract highly educated employees. This appropriation will allow College Possible to continue to support the over 5,000 students that we serve across the state. Thank you.
I've got a question on line 1.7, and this is either to Representative Vang or to Senior Director Allen. You've got 600,000 in each year. Can you tell me how that number was arrived at, and what was the previous number that we had funded College Possible at?
Mr. Chair, I believe the previous number was 550,000 per year on the base, and then I can leave it to my testifier to explain why the increase.
Okay,
Mr. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Vang. The increase is a 9% increase over our previous appropriation. We are seeing the cost of services provided increase significantly, as I think we're all aware of increases in inflation. So this is an inflation-based increase to allow us to continue services. It'll allow us to also invest in additional technology support for our coaches as they provide services. We're needing to see an increase in the efficiency that we provide in the ways that we provide services to our students. So we're looking to invest in some technological services to support our work.
All right, thank you. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So again, Mr. Chair, we don't have a 990 or an annual report or even a report in the most basic format of how the money was spent. You talked about how many students were served, but can you let me know in your 2022 990, if that's completed, if not the 2021, what was your total revenue and expenditures in that year for
Director
College
Allen.
Possible for Minnesota?
Director Allen.
Yes, I can speak to, can you state again which year you're looking for?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if you've got the 2022 already compiled and done, if not the 2021.
Yes. So,
Director Allen.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chair, so our 2020, speaking to our 2022 completed budget for our fiscal year, our total expenses, $5,554,569. So $5.5 million in total revenue. Consolidated expenses, $5,388,304. So 5.3 in expenses.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then how many staff do you have employed in Minnesota? And then if you will let me know your revenue sources. So obviously we didn't get all that from the state of Minnesota. Can you let me know the breakdown in revenue?
Director Allen.
Thank you. Total staff in Minnesota, we have 32 full-time staff and an additional 34 AmeriCorps members.
And then what was the additional question?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The sources of your revenue, obviously that doesn't all come from the state of Minnesota. So what are the other sources according to your 990?
Director Allen.
Yeah, we are a public-private partnership. So we have funding that comes from private foundations, private corporations, public corporations, and individual donors.
Representative O'Neill.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I understand that. That's pretty common, but I'm talking about the actual dollar amount or percentage that comes from foundations versus individual donations versus gifts in kinds, all the things. Do you have an I-90 that you
could, oh, yeah.
That would be wonderful. I think, not to give to me right this second, but that would be something that would be very important when you're asking for an increase as such as this, or even just a report back to us as to
Director
how you
Allen, if you
money.
Don't have it now, you can supply the committee with it.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, we also provide our audit and our 992 OHE as part of our reporting process.
All right. It would be appreciated. Any further discussion?
Just one last comment, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the only thing that was provided was this 2022 impact report, which has zero financial information on it. The very most basic things I just asked that should be provided with a 990 or the audited financial statements of the most current year. And so particularly if we're gonna be doing appropriations directly to nonprofits, we should be looking at all that. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Faye.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank the committee for your time and consideration to this bill. It's an important bill, and it has great impact for students like me. As you've seen, I've benefited greatly from this program. So thank you so much for your support.
Thank you. Any further discussion, members? Seeing none, meeting is adjourned.